This call is now being recorded.
Okay, hello there. This is Henry Reed, and you're listening to me in a conversation with Louis Mel Madrona and Barbara Mangai, and their latest book on remapping your mind. And Louis Mel Madrona has several books before this, Coyote Wisdom, Coyote Medicine, Narrative Medicine, that got me very exciting in the whole arc of his work, both from the idea of integrating what I would call gringo medicine with indigenous healing, as well as the emphasis on story as opposed to, let's say, cause and effect and physical factors. So it's, that is the kind of excitement and orientation that I'm bringing here to this conversation that we're going to have. So I'd like to open the floor here to Louis and say, Louis, you must be really excited and relieved and so on to have this new book coming out, especially with the brain aspect being emphasized or added to your support group, you might say. How do you feel about all that?
Well, really excited, as you said. It was, it was both a learning experience and a transformative experience to, to discover what one of our elders said he already knew, which is that neuroscience is finally catching up to the Lakota. So, it was pretty fun for us. We really tried to lay out how we work with people and to ground it in neuroscience, which, is just now beginning to understand more clearly, the incredible complexity of the brain and its relation to the world.
It reminds me, you're saying that, of that recent animated movie that came out about the girl and her emotions. That was then.
Oh, that's a wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, describing a psychological event in a story form, and maybe they would do the same thing. They'd have your version of neuroscience.
They could do that. I was thrilled about that movie because it makes it so easy for us to explain the concepts. To have a movie to direct people to is just fabulous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the things that I had found some, I would say, sympathy or overlap with you and my work was the, how did you feel about, I don't know if you'd call it grounding, but saying how, since your emphasis has been on story, to now turn to these physical effects in the brain as somehow, your partner in all of this. And so like in my work with the intuitive heart, we'll refer to heart math, and they've done a lot of work, outwardly looking at the brain and the heart in terms of its function relative to inner experience, where I'd be saying, how do we develop the confidence to believe in our inner experience for its own sake without the outer confirmation?
Right. For me, it was really a convergence of parallel streams because I did a postdoc in neuropsychology after getting a PhD in psychology. And so I do a lot of consultation liaison psychiatry in which we're figuring out, are these behavioral manifestations the result of a stroke? And if so, what area of the brain is involved? And so I've been active in neuroscience, for most of my career. And it was a wonderful convergence for the neuroscience and the story to come together for me to discover, that people are actually thinking about where story arises in the brain and what parts of the brain come to understand story and what is the function of story in our lives. Neuropsychologically.
And I think that for a lot of people, the science doesn't put them off, and it may even help them, kind of trust that intuitive story sense that they have more. Because for some people, it's a convincing thing to say, well, and look at this. There's actually some research into it. And so it may kind of, in a funny way, be helpful.
Well, I'm wondering if what we're describing is another form of consensus, that we have other people, perhaps it's indirect through results in a paper, or somebody is telling us about a study, or maybe they can actually see a needle move or something of that form. When you think about the whole essence of science was that although we're going to leave the security of whatever the Bible and the Pope says, we're going to instead have the security that we can compare our experiences with one another and go from there. And so I'm wondering if perhaps that referring to an outer source or a physical source might be another version of that human desire, you know, to seek consensus. One of the things that really had you to bring in, I think referring to Lakota or something of that, referring in your books all of the time to the influence of the indigenous heritage, let's say, the knowledge, the attitude, I think, as well. And I know for many of us, I know for me, growing up with a sense of what I might call indigenous envy, whereas it would seem like the indigenous people were in touch with something that I only knew in an intellectual kind of way, not as something that was in my blood. And it's been very interesting to read through the series of the books, how you'll often use the phrase, and as we were about to start this operation, and I'm using that word metaphorically, not necessarily surgery, interacting with a client or working on something, we also introduced the indigenous method, the indigenous sensibility, the indigenous approach of blah, 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 an additional dimension. And I thought such an interesting integration of these two things. And as I had mentioned to you in an email, you know, where do we get the indigenous gringo so that we could have that same in touch with those, that with spirit or whatever you might want to call it?
Well, you know, I think we all were indigenous once upon a time. We all were the original people from somewhere. And if you take it back far enough, of course, we all came from the same little corner of Africa. So, you know, we're all related.
Right.
And so it's an interesting question. How long do you have to live somewhere to be indigenous? So, you know, my favorite example is Diné in Arizona. I mean, they moved in around 1200 AD, and now they're considered indigenous. But in 1250, they were considered annoyed by the locals.
Uh-huh.
So, and not at all indigenous. Of course, over 800 years, they became much more like the Pueblo people and much less like their cousins from Saskatchewan that they left behind. And, you know, their stories morphed and became more like the Pueblo stories. Though interesting, the language didn't change very much at all. So in a sense, no one and everyone is indigenous. And, you know, we think we know people in France and Scotland who are working to bring back their indigenous origins, learning Gaelic, you know, recovering the ceremonies mm-hmm. from pre-Christian times, you know, enacting them. And I think that to the extent that we embrace a spirituality that's grounded in nature, you might say that it's an embodied spirituality of the earth, that we're neo-indigenous, that we're recovering indigenous, that we're bringing back, you know, we're reconnecting with that line of thought that was once ours.
Now, you seem to, at least from what I've sensed, hit on it in terms of the key of indigenous. Somebody was saying that what the Christian, Judaic, Muslim, Islam religion have in common is that they idealize a being, a person, Jesus, Muhammad. That the Eastern religions tend to idealize a state of consciousness, samadhi, enlightenment, what have you. And I ask, well, what then do indigenous religions, what do they idealize? And I would say relationship to nature would be their idealization. And that's kind of like what you're saying, it seems like.
I think that's a good simplification, because I think of one elder who said that, and Barbara can remember his name, whenever we do anything in nature, we mess something up. And so we have to continually apologize to nature for our messing around, for our, meddling nature.
Harry Charger,
right.
Yeah.
And so, it's a sense that nature has a perfection that we disturb, and that we have to apologize for that and to do what we can to be in harmony with nature and to disturb the world as little as possible. And of course, that's what people are talking about now, to have the minimum carbon footprint, to have green buildings that disturb the land the least. But no matter what we do, we create problems. And
yes, I can tell you, in the various Native American literature that I've read, the thing that has impressed me most is the profound humility and the attitude of the things, that makes me seem like a comparative blowhard fool, the way I approach things. And that, I think, is really something to use that thinking of apology or the forgiveness factor. I can't help but think, though, that creative spirit, is going to and somehow have a meddling aspect, or there wouldn't be a coyote and other things. I think that you call in coyote perturbance factor. It's interesting, here in our, where we sit, we can look out our window, and now and then we'll see one walking across the hill here. So to me, for example, I know with my brother, who's a minister of a more traditional Christian faith, when we first talked, and we didn't much talk after that about these things, about the Garden of Eden and the serpent tempting Eve. And I said, well, God made the serpent, so wasn't the serpent expressing some part of God's being to be a tempter? And God made Eve, for us to get into all this trouble? I mean, isn't that a part of things? And what do you think about that?
I'm curious what your brother said when you posed that question to him.
Could you repeat? I'm sorry.
I was saying when you posed that question to your brother.
That was serpent. His answer was the animals in the earth are really not of God in that sense. They were beasts and have no free will. They're just acting out of instinct. And I didn't go any farther than that because my mom and us didn't like us to have too many arguments. So we'd hug and not really go much farther. So I didn't get into, who designed these laws of nature and instinct, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, I think what's really interesting about some branches of Christianity is that notion of closed time. And I think, for the most part, indigenous spirituality is open time. So the idea of closed time is that God created everything in one instant all at once, and it's all perfect. And God knew everything that was going to happen, and it's all predestined. And whatever has happened to you is God's will, and so shut up and take your medicine. Whereas, open time
is more the idea that the creation is continually unfolding. So in the Cherokee creation story, creator has to try four times to get the world right. And on the fourth try, Buzzard comes to creator and says, look, you know, I watched you screw this up now three times, so I think I can help you get it right on the fourth try. And so they work together.
Yeah.
And in the Lakota cosmology, there's a wonderful story about setting the four directions. And unanticipated obstacles arise that creator didn't know to expect. And when brought to creator's attention, creator calls a meeting, first of all the animals, to help solve the problem, to come up with a solution for the problem. And then the second time, this happens, of all the plants, to help come up with a solution for the problem. And so you see in those stories that creation is collaborative. It's not a bang, one instant, and it's done, and fixed forever. But it just goes on and on. And here in the Northeast, there's a character named Glooskap, whose job was to sort of mop up creation, that creator did the broad strokes, and then Glooskap came down to do the finished carpentry. And again, in interaction with all of the beings who were found already on the earth. So it's really this idea that time is an open dialogue. And
right.
That many things can enter into the slipstream of time. And paths can converge, diverge, that there's no, that nothing is predetermined, that it's all part of an ongoing conversation which changes itself.
One of the things that I think that Edgar Cayce had said in one of his readings, and it might be echoing some other traditions, that God gave us time and space so we would have a stage and an opportunity to create this story of finding our way back home. Things wouldn't happen all at once in the same spot. I think Einstein sort of almost talks about that a little bit in terms of the time thing. Well, it's fun to get off into these topics, but I'm thinking in terms of your potential readers. Now, when I came out with that first blog, I got a lot of emails from folks who were thanking me for reminding them of your work. So they were unaware that you'd come out with a new book. And so I'm wondering if you might like to say a little bit about, well, off the top of your head, if the people who've read your previous books, why might they want to get this one? Is it sort of something more than saying, oh, now the physical sciences has proved I'm right. Hey.
Well, I think more so than ever in this book, we try to break out the techniques that we use to work with people.
I noticed that. And
we're trying to make it so that people can work with these ideas on their own or with other people. And
I find that to be a great challenge, you know. Here where I live now, the kids at this summer camp and I, through some dreams, channel a really interesting dream ceremony that we're trying to get to be spread out, you know. And I found I had to stop conducting this ceremony because they felt that somehow the magic of it was because of me. I said, no, you can do this. You can do this, you know. And my wife was one of the first ones. Hey, she went out and did it with Baptist ladies, and they got into it as well and trying to find some other people. So I'll be sure to emphasize that because I know that is a hard sell sometimes.
Well, people want other people to do it for them. And part of our job is to become heroic, I think, and to do it for ourselves, but not in isolation.
Yeah.
Well, you know, with
let
company.
Me ask you this question, Lewis. Once when this area of study about the interaction between the doctor and the patient And one of the things that was coming out was, like, if the doctor, through, say, reflective listening, showed compassion, say, and the patient felt it, they would go through surgery with less medicine and blah, blah, blah. And there was a phrase coming up as if there was an instinct for healing, but the instinct needed a trigger, just like other instincts. And the trigger comes from the physician, as if perhaps healing could not be initiated in an alone world, but did require some, quote, other, unquote. Like in the Greek Asclepian tradition, which is where I come from, you have the god appearing to you and healing you. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that that's absolutely true, that we need each other, and that there are these healing relationships that are powerful for us. And it's always paradoxical, because we have to do our own work, but we need other people to do it with.
Uh-huh.
And so if we rely too much on other people, then we don't do our own work. And if we rely too much on ourselves, then we don't get the powerful benefit of doing it together.
Sort of a mindful togetherness.
Mm-hmm.
In a way. Well, yes. Maybe I wanted a chance to share with you a story about storytelling, just for the selfish reason of hearing what you think of the method. I'm so pleased about it and how it came about. And this had to do with my work with the Edgar Cayce Foundation, having to audition people who said they had psychic ability, and I was auditioning them as to how helpful they seemed to me. Well, I wasn't actually measuring them on psychic ability, but they're using their abilities to help me, let's say. And I was questioning myself, practicing as a psychotherapist, it was a small part of what I did, wondering how in the world, if I were psychic, which I didn't think that I was, if I were psychic, how could I use that ability in my counseling practice without violating my ethic, basically, if they need to find their own way. I'm not there to tell them what's what, even though I could tell from working with the professional psychics, all of their clients expected that kind of behavior, that the psychic is going to tell them what's what. And so what I had decided was, is that if I could be really, not just psychic, but in tune and wise, that I would somehow be drawn to spontaneously, and I'm loving your reference to the work Free Play, because I'm a great fan of that book and improvisation, that I would be spontaneously inspired to tell the client a story on myself, something that I had experienced once. In the therapeutic literature, that seemed to be the least destructive type of transferential kind of intervention, as a self-disclosure. And if I could tell a story on myself that would kind of hit a button for them, and they could say, huh, you know, and something would snap for them. Just like when you told that story of that poor, pitiful girl, and you told about all the things, this fairy tale of all the things she had to put up with, and you put her life in such a different cast. And to see if somehow that would somehow make a mark on the other person. I wouldn't be telling them what to do, but maybe I could be inspired to share something of myself, and then they would know what to do. And so one day I got a call from a psychic who wanted to be auditioned, and she came to my office and then told me she didn't really want to be auditioned because she got tired of being a psychic. She just wanted to find out what we were up to. And so I told her everything, including, because she was telling me she couldn't get out of being a psychic because she would spontaneously say stuff that would inspire other people to say, hey, funny you would say that. And then she somehow subconsciously was tuning in. And so I told her I had imagined an activity like that, structured, you know, and so we tried it. And I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to think of a question, and it's bothering me, and I want you just to tune in and see if a memory comes to you spontaneously that you can use to me as a teaching story. And what I was thinking about was this problem that I was having getting my book written, which never did get written, and she started telling me about a time that she did a proposal for a tour for a hospital and took so long making it so perfect that by the time she got the proposal to them, they had already signed up with another company. And I thought she really had hit the nail on the head that way in terms of coming up with a story that had a lesson for me. And I thought she validated the sort of my thought experiment about how an idealistic use of intuition might happen between one person trying to help another. What's your reaction or thinking about that kind of a little experiment? It's very replicable and studyable.
Yes, you know, and I love, you sent me that story, and I loved it when I read it. It brought up so many associations for me. And I think the first thought that I had was speaker-listener-neuro-coupling, which is a recently discovered phenomena that when I tell a story, the same parts of your brain light up when you listen to my story
uh-huh.
and lit up in me when I tell the story.
Right, uh-huh.
And so we're synchronizing. When I tell you a story, we're entering into synchrony.
Uh-huh.
And I don't mean to discount extrasensory
sources. Oh, it doesn't matter. It's all one.
Yes. But I think what we do in those contexts is we entrain each other to be more sensitive on all fronts.
Oh, Lord. Okay. It's interesting what you're saying about that because it brings up something that's in your book and that's like with dreams. People ask me, if dreams are supposed to guide us, how come they just don't tell us what to say, what to do? And I say, well, look, how many do you know about things you could be doing to improve your life right now but you're not doing? Of course. So if dreams told you what to do, you could ignore them. Instead, they give you an experience. They take you through a story. And in the indigenous view of what happens in dreams, and Edgar Cayce's view is very, very similar, but you might say your soul is trying to get you in empathy with its perspective, and there's an entrainment going on, as you would say, between your conscious self and your soul self as you awaken from the dream. You're changed.
Right. And you know, we have that experience. I mean, as a physician, I know that when I tell somebody what to do, they never do it.
Right.
So,
exactly.
So it's so true that we have to come to things on our own. And the work of healing or community is to bring us to a place where we can see what everyone else around us already sees.
I'd love to be able to see myself the way other people see me. As I get older and older, I value that more and more. Also in this work, my work has been on how to introduce intuition into the culture in such a way that we can learn that we can have consensual validation at the intuitive realm. It doesn't have to be at the sensory realm. And what that's brought up for me is a whole different approach to how we understand the self and the idea, all my relations, you know, which comes from at least a Native American, if not a pan-indigenous tradition, all my relations seems to be a much more realistic definition of who a person is than any kind of, you know, more of a field effect than an atom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got one idea. I was just going to say that something I always think confirms consensual validation at the intuitive realm is driving on a highway.
Mom taught me that, pulling out into the interstate when I was a kid in California. Yeah, exactly. A lot of merging and so on. Yeah, I think you're exactly right, yeah.
And it happens so fast that it isn't possible for us to process in the normal way sensory information.
Right.
We're making incredibly intuitive decisions, or there would be no such thing as highway driving. So.
Well, I think you're probably right.
Where we live, I don't see very many cars, but I grew up in San Diego and the interstate and all of that. So much. Well, Barbara, what's it been like for you working on this book? I was really surprised. I mean, it comes out this new book, and now your name's on it, too. Has it been fun for you to be a co-author?
Yeah, it's been really fun. I mean, I think it's been wonderful the way that, you know, I think that what Lewis talks about in his work and what he brings us into awareness of just really reaches into what good therapy does. And I think, it really shifted, like you say, free play. You know, in my tradition of therapy, which is drama therapy, we use improvisation a lot. We really like to get people out of their... Bella, come.
At home in your book. Yeah, I think one of the things, Barbara, I was guessing... That you added to the book compared to the previous ones?
Yeah.
Are you there?
Say that again, sorry? Hi,
Barbara.
Sorry.
What I felt I noticed about this last book and your presence in it was more of a sense of making us present in an interaction or an intervention or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I think it does allow for us to be. I'm sorry, I'm out with my dog and another dog being very playful around her. Speaking of interactions, Bella, come.
Yeah.
And I think it's possibly interesting for people to see people working together, which we do. And I think it can be interesting for people to see what it's like when you're working with a co-therapist and the kinds of decisions. So maybe it reveals a little bit about how we end up being, making decisions about where to go in a situation.
Uh-huh.
So it's a nice way to reveal the work through being observing some experience with it. So
right.
That you can, instead of saying, then we decided to do this, you can see us working together and see the kind of things that we're doing. And it's more fun to do it as two people in a lot of ways when
right.
you're working with
someone. I know that. My wife and I had done some programs together. She got to see how I would conduct the Dream Helper ceremony. And after a while, I said, I don't want to do it anymore. And now she's doing it on her own in a totally different way, drawing in people, having a great time. But I have an interesting story to tell in that regard from Japan, where I was invited over to Japan to do a workshop, and we were in a Buddhist monastery, and a husband and wife, Buddhist priests, were there officiating, and they were serving us our meal. And the man priest said a prayer over our soup. And it was a wonderful prayer that I've used ever since, not the exact words, but to think of all the people and all the efforts that went into making the soup that we were about to eat, that grew it and processed it, made the bowl, and all those things. And then afterwards, the woman priest came around to each one of us individually and asked us if we were enjoying our soup. And that was so different. Those two were both important, but they were very different. And watching my wife when she, the things that she would introduce to the workshops when I was there in terms of slowing down, more attention to the feeling of the people and less maybe to the teaching and so on. And now she's doing it on her own without my presence whatsoever and looking for that same feeling in this fourth book. So I just think it was kind of neat. And what did you think about her participation, Lewis?
Oh, it was much more fun than doing it by yourself.
Oh,
And enriching, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
It's not easy to
do a book, especially these days. And I really appreciate your persistence and the growth through the things. I was looking on your website. I'm going to be sure to include that in this article. Is there anything there? I've kept you for some time. I really do appreciate it. Is there anything that you'd like to say or comment before we finish for the day?
Well, I think our focus is to bring what's really powerful about indigenous or aboriginal cultures into the mainstream. And I think that one of the most powerful ideas is community, that we need each other and that we help each other to grow. And we tell people, if you don't have community, call up everyone you know and invite them to come over to your house at a specific time for the purpose of being healing for each other, and see who shows up. And, you know, if only one other person shows up, well, that's a community. And you can keep meeting. You can build it from there. And, you know, I started a group like that in New York City in the 1990s, and it's still meeting. Without me, of course, I moved. You know, so it's a powerful idea to begin to create micro communities where people can go and not have to pay money, but just go and feel loved and nurtured and have an opportunity to experience receiving healing and giving healing together. So that would be my closing thought, is everyone run out and do this.
Well, that certainly seems to be my mission. As I've tried to describe it to myself, I don't know, is to try to provide the indigenous sensibility for our gringo culture. And where I've identified it a little different from what you're saying is, what do I see in the indigenous culture? They are able to bring the altered states, psychic phenomena, and so on into the religious circle of how they're dealing with one another, whereas we put all those things to a side and then look upon them enviously. And then when the hippie culture came in with the psychedelics and Jungian psychology and all of that, there was a total revisiting of indigenous culture and an extreme envy of that. I was embarrassed sometimes. They use the word now, cultural appropriation. And I can remember when I came out with the Sundance Journals, I went through a lot of inner turmoil about whether or not I even had the right to use that name, even though it had come to me in a dream and the ideal behind it exactly matched. I still felt it was like an appropriation, and I felt unduly impoverished. That where's our own? And so, like with the Dream Helper ceremony, this came from just regular folks being, in a way, gringos can be together. And I think out here in the country, we live up in the Appalachians area and so on, that you hit it for me when you say community, getting together with community. And that's happening, whether it's the farmers market. And just recently, my wife participated in a gathering of healings where they just gave back rubs to one another and prayed over one another. And maybe this is the thing to look at in terms of where to find that special spirit we think of as, quote, indigenous, is the nature that you talked about, and B is community, getting together and as community. Barbara, do you have any last words?
I was going to sort of link the two of you together, because what I'm thinking is that, you know, these things that you're talking about, these experiences of intuition and if you like, the psychic experiences, arise when we are in community in a good way with each other.
Yeah.
So when we drop into community and when we allow ourselves to believe in ourselves and believe in our abilities to tap into that call of healing energy that occurs when we stand in front of one another in a good way, when we're present in a good way with the intention of being healing, amazing things happen. And we all have that ability to connect and to connect to kind of the forces. And
right.
I do think that that's what we learn in indigenous, if you like it, communities, is to be open to that and to trust that. So I think a piece of our work is encouraging people to trust that thing that arises when we're present for each other in a good way and tap into that feeling. And I was once told by somebody, you know, when I was very first beginning this way, I was told, if you don't know what to do, just fill your heart with love.
You know, if you don't know what to do in a situation with someone, fill your heart with love and allow it to flow through you. And that was certainly
talking again, you know, that free play, love to do as you will.
So I think that you both are working in the same way and tapping into that beautiful energy that we share. And that is, I think, what the plane or the field of healing is, that field of that connectedness and that energy. And we can't help but, you know, some people are told, as you say, they're told, you know, don't believe in that woo-woo stuff, you know, and I think that's just wrong, but I think it's there, and I think that, you know, what the hippies were trying to do was to access that field, and I think more and more we all understand that that field is present in a human way in all of us, and that, you know, what the indigenous communities maybe did was not lose sight of that. So I think, you know, we've got it to open up, and so I guess that's the work you're doing, and that's very commendable to just, you know, get people to get back into it and open it up. And I think what we try to do with the work we do is try to give them experiences that inevitably tap into that. So when if we're working with someone, we're working in a way that we hope gives them a thing to do that inevitably opens up that field for them. So,
I think that's really true. Made me wonder, did you guys ever cross paths with Rolling Thunder?
I did. I was good friends with his bodyguard, one of his chief bodyguard, who's hopefully still alive. His name was Mountain, and he was truly a mountain.
Uh-huh.
He was one of the biggest men I ever met. So through Mountain, I heard a lot of stories about Rolling Thunder. Of course, we know Sam.
I had contact with him from within, but we'd also, he came to the manager's clinic many, many years ago in one of his first public appearances, and a number of the people there, including some doctors, had their children there, and so one of the kids got hurt in a soccer ball game. And so one of the doctor asked Rolling Thunder if he'd be willing to perform a healing for us to all to watch. And so he did that, and he asked for some steaks to be prepared and so on and brought, and we got to watch. And he began by asking the boy to describe what happened to him. He had a bad knee now from a hurt knee. What happened to him? And then he asked the boy, why did he want his knee to get well? And the boy explained, because he really liked playing soccer, and he went on, and Rolling Thunder did his thing. And after it was all done, the doctor, who was sort of officiating, got up and was talking about how important it was. Rolling Thunder asked the boy about why he wanted to get well, you know, why he wanted to get his knee well, and it sort of pointed that out as a pretty important kind of thing. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I want to really thank you both. I know we're wanting to promote the work and so on, but still in our busy days and so on, and to sit back and be able to have a conversation. I will have this recorded and archived and publicized and so on. I think you guys are doing fantastic work. When I read especially this last book, I felt like all the little things that I've played around with and done over the years would have had a real good home at your place. It really made a lot of sense. One of the things I'll close with, you get a picture of this. We're standing together, a bunch of us. I say, it must be known somewhere within us that we're really all one, and that we could look one another in the eyes, and we could feel with our hearts, and we can dance and walk about and hug as if, you know, because we're feeling this reality. If we only knew what to do, we want to research into enlightenment so that we can have this experience. And so let's dream together. Let's dream together, and tomorrow let's honor our dreams with the assumption that our dreams will be urging us, having, what was your term? We aligned with them, some electrical term, refinement. I forget the word that you used, but now we're all being driven by our dreams. We wake up in the morning we have these dreams, but we don't know what to do. And then Barbara comes in with this improvisational drama, and we start enacting this little piece of that dream and that little piece of the other dream, and little bit by little bit, and pretty soon we're starting this spontaneous dance drama amongst one another, where we're seeing and regarding and imagining each other in some kind of a way that the spirit is one, and the coyote and the dove and all come together in one, and we say, it's true, it's true, it's here, it's now. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So easy for me to imagine when I'm with you guys. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for
thank you.
Okay,
thank
I'm
going to so
turn
much.
Off the recording now.
Recording has ended for this call.